this cannot play out in a good way. Israel, as you say, has now prepared its forces for a land invasion. It seems inevitable that that's going to happen, probably over this coming weekend. That's going to be an extraordinarily difficult operation for Israel to carry out. They'll be fighting in an urban environment where Hamas will have booby traps everywhere and will be able to come at them from behind.
Welcome to the Debate at Geo8 podcast series. We've all been shocked and horrified by the recent events taking place in the Middle East. The ramifications continue to reverberate around the world, even here in Australia. One man who's been keeping a close watch on Middle Eastern politics for decades is Ian Parmeter from the Australian National University Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies. He was formerly Australia's ambassador to Lebanon and has also had postings to Egypt, Syria and Saudi Arabia. He's an expert in his field. The ANU Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies has been in existence for 30 years. Its work is more important than ever in this time of crisis because it can provide a considered contribution to public commentary in what is a very polarising debate. It underlines the importance of our universities as Australian leaders and policymakers seek to understand all the issues and not get captured by one argument or the other. Hello, my name's Ron Candlars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer, and throughout this series we've been canvassing a range of topics touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland and Western Australia. Also joining us in the Podbooth studio is the CEO of the Group of Eight, Vicky Thompson. Ian Parmeter, thanks for your time today. Let's try to put some context to the horrors we've witnessed in recent days. Middle Eastern politics is incredibly complex with a very bloody history. But can you provide us with a potted history that provides some understanding how we've arrived at these most recent events?
Well, it certainly goes back a very long way. Really to the British Mandate when the whole area was controlled by Britain and the gradual settling of parts of Palestine by Jewish, at that point, settlers, well before the creation of Israel. But there was a division of the country created in 1947, which gave a state to Israel and a state to Palestine. The Israelis accepted that, but the Palestinians didn't. And as a result, there was the War of 1948, which resulted in the establishment of Israel. But the big problem for the Palestinians was they had no state at all. And it's often said that if they had accepted the state at that point, they would now be able to be in a much stronger position in terms of prosecuting their arguments. But it's gone on with several wars in the Middle East. We had a war in 1956. We had another one in 1967. Then in 1973, just 50 years ago, almost exactly, and with uncanny parallels where Israel was caught surprised by Egypt and Syria with that war. And then there have been sort of smaller wars in Lebanon by Israel in 1982. And then we got in 1993 to the first of the Oslo Accords, which promised some way ahead for the Palestinians. Now, they were meant to provide a final settlement between Israel and the Palestinians within 10 years. That didn't happen, and the result is that Israel now has started making peace with individual Arab states and done so very successfully. It's made peace with four states under the Abraham Accords, the United Arab Emirates, with Bahrain, with Sudan, and also with Morocco. And it's been very close. It's been negotiating with Saudi Arabia to have a separate peace agreement or normalization of arrangements with Saudi Arabia. Now, all of this has left the Palestinians really last in the queue. And it's this which has led to, I think, an outbreak of frustration. It wasn't just from Hamas and from Gaza. It's also been building up in the West Bank, where there have been clashes all of this year between settlers and people in the West Bank. And the West Bank is becoming even more radicalized because there are a lot of young people who are forming under a group called the Lion's Den, which has the potential to be just as menacing towards Israel as Hamas has been. So Israel faces problems there. On top of all of this, Israel has great difficulty forming governments because it has a very complicated electoral system. It's proportional representation. So it's very hard for in fact, impossible for one party to get a complete majority, as in Australia. And the consequence is that the Prime Minister Netanyahu, at the end of last year, put together a coalition of very right-wing parties, which has actually moved Israeli policy towards the Palestinians very much to the right. And it's been in large extent in reaction to this that the Palestinians, I think, have been determined to get their case back to the top of the Middle East agenda, which is what this issue of what Hamas has done. This is in no way, I must emphasize, to condone what Hamas has done. What they've done is murderous and utterly brutal. There's no excuse for the violence that they have carried out. But the problem is that it now leaves Israel with a new problem to face in the Middle East. It's now going to have to deal with Hamas. It's going to have to, it said it will eradicate it. We'll have to see if they can do that. But it also needs to see what sort of new policy it can come up with in terms of dealing with the region.
So do you believe that basically because of the arrangements that Israel have been making with separate Arab states, you know, as part of the Abraham Accords, that Hamas and Hezbollah, a proxy for Iran, had been left out in the cold, so to speak? So this is the thing that's really caused this event of most recent days.
I wouldn't say that Hezbollah has been left in the cold. I mean, it's simply remained in the cold. Hezbollah wants no dealings with Israel except military. With Hamas, I think there could be some other factors which we may only be partially aware of at this stage. Hamas is not the only radical Islamist group in the West, in Gaza, and it does have some elements in the West Bank as well. But in Gaza, there are even more radical groups. There's Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and there are other smaller elements which actually don't accept Hamas as their leader, and which are quite prepared to act separately. But the big problem is that Gaza itself is an unviable entity as it currently stands. It's an area about the size of the quarter of Hobart, with a population 10 times the population of Hobart. And it's growing because there are a lot of young people there. So Gaza itself has been described as the largest open-air prison in the world. And it's likely to remain that way. The big problem that I think we now face is that it will probably, in my view, take generations for the horrors of what's been happening in the past week to be got over, really, by both sides. So I really don't see any positive movement in the peace process occurring for quite some time. The only thing that could happen, I think, is that after a time, Saudi Arabia might resume its dealings with Israel. But one thing that the attacks by Hamas has done has been to put the Saudi negotiations with Israel very much to the side. Saudi Arabia won't make a deal with Israel at this point while this fighting is going on.
So knowing the region as you do, given your experience and also obviously as a scholar at the ANU Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies, it's a fairly pessimistic outlook by the sounds of it. And we're recording this on Friday the 13th. So, you know, I think from news reports, we're on the precipice, at least the Israeli Defence Force is on the precipice of ground assault. And one assumes that revenge that they will exact will be fairly swift. At what point does this then become a humanitarian crisis as well as a military conflict? Because as you've said, Gaza has been described as the world's largest open prison. Not everybody is a terrorist who lives in Gaza. There are 2.2 million people there. What happens and how does Israel actually respond in that context?
Well, it's already a humanitarian crisis. We've seen pictures on television last night of the consequences of the Israeli bombing of Gaza, pictures of you know, really very innocent people, just children and clear civilians. I think a point to be made is that not all the people in Gaza want to get involved in fighting with Israel. Mm-hmm. I have seen credible reports of people in streets in Gaza coming and remonstrating with Hamas fighters who want to fire rockets from their street, saying, don't do that because the retribution will come against us and our houses will be destroyed. So there are a lot of elements that are playing there. But the humanitarian crisis with Israel having cut off electricity, water, food, everything going into Gaza means that it's going to be we are going to see more pictures like that. Israel says it will keep this blockade up until Hamas decides to release the 100-odd prisoners that it currently has. That hasn't worked in the past. We'll just have to see how it does on this occasion. But Hamas has threatened also to kill some of these prisoners if Israel bombs civilian buildings, apartment buildings, without giving warning to civilians. Now, if they start killing them and the pictures come out of that, emotions are going to rise extremely high. This cannot play out in a good way. Israel, as you say, has now prepared its forces for a land invasion. It seems inevitable that that's going to happen, probably over this coming weekend. That's going to be an extraordinarily difficult operation for Israel to carry out. They'll be fighting in an urban environment where Hamas will have booby traps everywhere and will be able to come at them from behind at various times. The Israelis presumably are working out a strategy for doing it. Something I've seen is they may try to divide the strip into various sectors so that they would get gradual control on the way rather than take them all in at one hit. But it's going to be a very difficult operation. I think just in this same context that Prime Minister Netanyahu has been very wise in getting the Benny Gantz, one of the opposition leaders, into his cabinet. Gantz is a highly respected military figure, a former head of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and a very respected and moderate figure, moderate in the sense of being cool-headed. He has credibility. And Netanyahu, I think, wanted to get someone like him, and preferably him, involved because he wanted to get their ownership as well of the invasion of Gaza, which is now going to happen. So that all sides of the political divide in Israel are supporting the government action.
What impact do you think an invasion by the Israelis of Gaza will have when it comes to Hezbollah and Iran?
Well, that's something that really remains to be seen. Iran has applauded, and Hezbollah has applauded what Hamas has done. Now, Secretary of State Blinken has said that the United States doesn't have any intelligence indicating that Iran was involved in this. And that is probably right, because to do that, they would have had to use communications, and Israel would have picked these up. And the extraordinary thing about this attack that took place last Saturday was the way in which Hamas was able to keep its planning for it as secret as it did. This must have been planned for months, many months. Now, the point, getting back to your question, though, the point about Hezbollah is Iran's creature. Hezbollah will do what Iran tells it to do. Now, our feeling has been for many years that Iran has been keeping Hezbollah in reserve in case there is an attack by Israel or the United States on Iran's nuclear facilities. They would have a force in Lebanon which could rain rockets down on Israel to try to retaliate against Israel. Now, if if Hezbollah gets involved in this fighting, it certainly would cause a problem for Israel. We certainly would find that it could potentially overwhelm the Iron Dome aerial defense, which Israel has. But if that happens, it would be using up its store of rockets. And that means that Iran itself won't necessarily have Hezbollah as its backup when it needs it. So there are a lot of questions about that. We haven't as yet. Hezbollah has what I'd say, indicated some token opposition firing some rockets into Israel, but it has, we believe, about 150,000 rockets and would be very capable of getting rid of all of those and completely overwhelming the Iron Dome defence if it got involved. And if that happened, and also if the West Bank were to rise up, Israel could then have a war on three fronts, which could stretch it.
You talked about, you know, this had been planned for months. I have had the privilege of travelling to Israel, certainly not as many times as you have in your professional capacity, but both for me in a professional and a personal capacity. And most recently I was there in July. And I always felt, just from an observer's perspective, that it was a country that is, in a positive and a negative way, on the edge. So, you know, there is this kind of feeling that anything could happen, both positively and negatively, and particularly with younger people. In 2019, I visited as part of a chief executive women's delegation, and we had the opportunity to meet with members of the Israeli Defence Force, particularly women in the Defence Force, but also to view their intelligence capabilities in as much as we were able to, and particularly around their cybersecurity capability. And I'm just really, and I guess it's a question a lot of people have, and you've talked about, you know, history dictating the future, but looking back, how did, given they have this renowned experience in terms of cyber technology, cyber defence, how did Hamas do this on that watch? How did that happen? I'm interested in your views on that.
Yes, how did they miss it? I mean, I am amazed too, as you say. I've been to Israel many times, and I've been privileged in the work I've been doing to have close discussions with the various Israeli intelligence agencies, and I've been extremely impressed with them. They are really top notch, very good indeed. They also have remarkable sources of intelligence within Gaza. They're both in terms of satellite surveillance, in terms of human intelligence, in terms of picking up all the communications. That no one, it's often said that you couldn't have a mouse running across the street without Israeli intelligence being aware of it. But they didn't pick this up. Now, this is going to be a once the immediate crisis is over and Israel is in some way on top of all this, which still could take several months, there will be a major inquiry into what went wrong. And I have no doubt that heads will roll. Now, interestingly in this, the last time that something like this happened in 1973, the Prime Minister was Golda Meir, whom, of course, you'll remember. And she was gone within 6 months. Mm. She was really a victim of that, the fact that Israel was caught napping in the 1973 war. Now, Netanyahu will not want the same thing to happen. So he'll be determined, as part of the operation, to re-establish not just Israel's credibility in terms of its defence, its ability to defend itself, but also the people's faith in him as someone who can protect them. And that could be a big ask at this point. So, I agree with your point entirely. There's always a sense in Israel when you're there that something could happen. That it's a very odd environment. It's a country that is inevitably on the edge, and will be even more so as we get to into the future. I mean, this what's happened in the past week is going to affect Israel for years now, possibly for generations.
I mean, it is quite an intoxicating blend, Ron, of both vibrancy and risk mm-hmm. is how I sort of felt. Always felt safe in my time there, but you just kind of felt, you know, just as somebody who's not in this world, you know, driving down to the southern areas of Israel, which we did, you know, and there were military bases and there are tanks and there are planes coming out of the ground. And so it's such a different environment to what we are used to and what we know here in Australia, which brings me, I guess, to your observations, Ian, on how the Australian government is actually dealing with the situation at the moment. We've seen certainly on our university campuses and major protests and or at least demonstrations and rallies at the Sydney Opera House. And I'm just interested in your perspective of how we are managing it both externally in the global context but also internally on a domestic front.
First of all, I think the Australian government has quite rightly condemned the attacks and made that very clear and indicated support for Israel in what was really a very tragic situation for the country. So that was important to happen. A problem that I think is looming is that Australia, of course, is a multicultural society. We have a significant population of Arab descent, as well as people who are of Jewish descent or identify with Israel in some form. And the big difficulty for the Australian government now is going to be balancing those interests. There inevitably are going to be demonstrations on both sides. I think, and I don't know if this is happening yet, but I think it would be very important for elements of the Australian government to talk to people on both sides of this divide, to establish contact with community leaders in the Arab community, to make sure that the demonstrations don't turn violent. Now, there's no doubt that particularly once Israel starts with a land assault on Gaza, emotions are going to be very high, both within the Jewish community and also within the Arab community. And this is going to be a lot more difficult for the Australian government to manage. And it's going to have to do this in coordination as well with the state government, because they, of course, have got a very primary role, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, where the majority of intercommunal populations live. So it's going to be very much a challenge. And I don't know, I'm not in government now, but I hope the government is considering this.
But it brings to sharp focus the importance of organisations such as yours, doesn't it? The ANU's Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies, which has been in existence for 30 years. You need people who've been studying this for three decades to understand the nuance and to provide decent advice to policymakers.
That's right. And that's something that I and others in the with the centre have been trying to do. Our aim, of course, is not to take sides. Well, I gave a course last year on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and I made the point right at the start to the students that I was not going to be taking sides on this. We were going to be looking at this conflict purely as an academic exercise. We were not there to make judgments because we're not part of it, and that is our aim. What we're trying to do is coldly and dispassionately, to the extent that this can be done, to analyse what's going on and where things are going to go. And certainly, I and all of my colleagues want to make very clear that we are not passing judgment on anyone on this. Obviously, we condemn what Hamas has done, but we're not saying that one side is utterly right and one side is utterly wrong. It's an area that is a great human tragedy on both sides.
It's interesting, though, because obviously, you know, it's a very vexed issue. And I noticed in 2019, you wrote a paper entitled "What's Wrong with Australia's Middle East Policy?" And in it, you described the Middle East as a conundrum for Australian policymakers. What do you mean by that?
It's because they get pulled in all directions. What I discovered when I was working in the Foreign Affairs Department is that the pro-Israel lobby is extraordinarily effective, and they work very well with Australian politicians. They They are very professional and they're very, very good at what they do. Now, as I said in that paper, I don't have a problem with this. Lobbying is an activity that's open to all sides of the Australian community. And the pro-Israel community does this very well. When people on, well, Arab friends I've got would sometimes complain to me about the Australian government's approach, I would say, well, if you don't like it, organise yourselves. Get yourselves into a lobby group. And one of the big problems, of course, over the years, and maybe this will change, has been that there has been very little unity among all of the Arab groups. They have been divided into their own community groups and haven't been nearly as united as they might be. So it's a difficult issue for Australian politicians. We have already seen this in terms of internal Labor Party debates that have happened recently with particularly Bob Carr pushing for greater support for the Palestinian cause and people pushing back on that. So it's an area where Australian governments and Australian political parties see it as being an area where they really can't win very much. If they leap in one direction, support one group, they're going to upset other groups. So it's a very difficult area of policy making for them.
Can I read you?
Also, we're a long way away, and we obviously don't want to get involved in muddying the waters in any way with the region.
Can I read you another quote that you wrote a while back? An associated weakness of Australian Middle East policy is that it tends to lurch between periods of major, even hyperactivity, and relative passivity. The former has usually coincided with Labor governments, with a pronounced correction to the latter state when the coalition assumes power. Can you talk to that a bit?
Yes, I think we've seen it that way. I mean, I've worked basically in the Foreign Affairs Department since 1976, although I went to the Office of National Assessments in 2005. But I worked very closely with Gareth Evans when he was Foreign Minister. And he took a great interest in the Middle East and was very much involved, certainly in trying to give the Australian perspective to Israel. When the change of government occurred after the Hawke era, the Hawke-Keating era in 1996, there was clearly a change of approach that came in with the Howard government. They really stepped back and did become more pro-Israeli, and that was reflected, I think, in the public statements that were made. I mean, to give an example, I remember at the time of one of the Lebanese wars when I was there in 1996, there was a terrible massacre of people sheltering from Israeli bombings at Qana in southern Lebanon, and there were about 100 people killed. There was a fairly moderate statement put out by the then Prime Minister, John Howard, but at the same time, the Deputy Prime Minister called it an atrocity. When I was asked by the Foreign Ministry what's the Australian government's perspective, I did give them what the Prime Minister had said, but I also gave them a cutting of what Tim Fisher had said, which tended to balance it a bit more. But that's the way that I've seen it. I've noticed that it's been an area where particularly the coalition side has seen that it hasn't been an area where they've been able to make very strong gains politically. So they've tended to step back or simply to take a pro-Israeli stance. Under Labor, they've tended, with foreign ministers like Gareth Evans and Bob Carr, they've tended to be rather more pro. I think they would call it even-handed, so that we're not being particularly supportive of one side or the other. And of course, always at the same time, offering our good offices when we can, because we've been involved in peacekeeping in the region as well. With UNSA, the United Nations Truth Supervisory Organization in Lebanon. We've been involved in the multinational force of observers in Sinai after the Egyptian and Israeli peace treaty in 1980. And we even got involved in Iraq, of course, with the after at the end of the Iran-Iraq war in 1988. So we're prepared to play a role in peacekeeping, which I think is appropriate. But what I've noticed is our policy has tended to lurch somewhat in terms of our public statements.
So which is the right approach from your perspective then?
Sorry, that?
So which is the right approach from your perspective?
Well, Gareth Evans has always been my favourite minister, and I think he had the most intellectual approach and did it very well. I might add that Gareth didn't make friends with people on either side. He upset both sides. I mean, I sat in on meetings that Gareth had with Arab ambassadors, and he would give them the round of the kitchen, and he would really hit them with all of the mistakes they had made. But then when he went to Israel, he would be equally blunt with them. Mm. I mean, this is an area where I think blunt talking can work effectively. It can just make both sides feel that we're watching what they're doing and we're making our own judgments on them.
So, Ian, to end up then, it's an incredibly difficult issue and a bit of a nightmare at the moment. But what's your long-term view about the possibilities into the future of any two-state solution? It seems ridiculously remote now.
I'm afraid it does. I've been pessimistic well before this about the prospects for a two-state solution, partly because a lot of the area where the two states might be carved out has now been filled by settlers, Israeli settlers, who won't be moved. I've said for quite some time that I think all that's left for the Palestinians is a one-state solution, which is simply to say, okay, we in a sense give up on the idea of trying to have our own state. We simply want to be part of the state of Israel, and we want equal rights. That would in itself create a huge conundrum for Israel, because if that were the case, it well could be that at some time in the future there would be more people of Arab background who are citizens of Israel than people of Jewish background, which of course would mean it could no longer be a Jewish state. So we've got an extraordinary future, extraordinarily difficult future to look forward to in the Middle East. It's not going to get any better, I'm afraid.
Well, Ian Parmeter, thank you very much for your time today, and we'll watch events with interest as they evolve over time. Thank you very much for your time today. Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune into the debate at GO8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.